That choir and Mr. Scott really was one of the loveliest things I've ever heard. As was your voice, sir, two octaves deeper than usual. The rosebud on the communion table this morning is in honor of Ryan Michael Crosser, about 3 months old, strikingly handsome young man. Son of Lane and Cheryl Crosser, who will become members of this church along with 10 others next Sunday. I suppose everybody in this room has gotten up in the morning in some strange place and wondered where he or she was for a minute. Kind of a disorienting experience. And I had it this morning because I'm not used to seeing Larry and Anita and Roy Craig and the Caraway family on this side of the room. I don't know whether I can make it through or not. You're willing to go back, John, if necessary. I'll try. About 400 years before Christ was born, a remarkable man by the name of Socrates said to the Greeks something like this: "There is truth we do not practice and do not seem to know, and I intend to speak this truth." And his fellow citizens, who thought they knew everything worth knowing, put him to death. Christ said, "Our knowledge is not complete. I bring you new truth." And those he would have taught put him to death. An Italian scientist named Galileo, 16 centuries later, said, "I have discovered new knowledge about the sun and the earth, and the church, which was sure it had a monopoly on truth, sentenced him to death." Obviously, it can be dangerous to share new insights with people who have shut all doors and windows. So in our series of sermons on how agape love works, we need to spend a morning on the relationship between love and knowledge. Let's begin with a comment made 20 centuries ago by the Apostle Paul, and another that was made recently by a student to one of his professors. The Apostle describes the human condition like this: "For now we see through a glass darkly." At least that's how he's translated in the old King James Version of the Bible, which I'm using for a moment in order to get a title. But it's not a good translation. It sounds as if Paul might be talking about dirty windows when he's really talking about seeing things dimly in a rather poor mirror. Not polished glass with a coated back like ours, but a piece of polished bronze which reflected a rather weak and distorted image. So it became a symbol for Paul of our inability in this life ever to see things perfectly. He was dealing with some people in a church who thought they knew it all, people puffed up with their knowledge, positive they were right, intolerant of those who interpreted the reflections differently. Paul reminds them that in this life, our knowledge is like a puzzling reflection in a poor mirror, always partial, always subject to correction. Knowledge of ourselves and the intricate wirings that make us tick, knowledge of the ultimate mystery we call God, knowledge of that complex volume of books we call the Bible. It should make us humble and cautious. It doesn't. We form opinions, set them in cement, and disregard or persecute people who ask us to reconsider. Paul may warn us all he likes that we never know for sure that mystery lies all around us, but the response of the dogmatist is, "You may not have the final answers, Paul, but I do, and given a chance, I will turn them into law for everybody." I don't know whether you saw it, but a couple of days ago I read about the militant Muslim fundamentalists who are now making their religious law into law for everybody on the streets and in the houses of Kabul in Afghanistan. Women go back behind the veil. Men may not touch alcohol or gamble. Give a militant fundamentalist a gun, and his faith becomes your law. I haven't forgotten the student I mentioned. A professor got a manuscript from this student one day, along with a note in which the young man said he intended to write several books and that this was just the first one. In those books, he said, "I shall explain the universe." Can you imagine trying to convince a boy with that kind of confidence that when he grows up, he'll be too smart to try it? That he will know so much less than he does now, that his boast remembered will deeply embarrass him, that he will discover, if his brain doesn't snap shut, that life is set in a limitless sea of mystery? It wouldn't be easy. What has been learned just in our lifetimes is incredible. But each time we push the frontier back, the universe gets even more mysterious. Quasars, pulsars, black holes, the theory of the expanding cosmos, a new ton of questions for every ounce of knowledge. One nameless poet who wrote part of the Bible spoke of the four corners of the earth. He could not have imagined that we live on a globe that flies around the sun at more than 1,000 miles an hour. And if it's true of the physical universe, it's equally true of something closer and more compact, our own lives. It's a queer business, the human adventure. And the older you get, the stranger it seems. Mysterious from the start, when a single cell carries on its slender bridge the whole amazing weight of inherited possibilities, to the moment of death, when the mysteriously compounded organism dissolves into its elements. And in between these two poles of human life, how strangely the beauty of it rubs shoulders with ugliness. How agonizingly triumph and tragedy hold hands. Pick any day you like, and some healthy and beautiful child is winning with thrilling grace an athletic contest before his happy parents, while in a hospital nearby, another child is learning that disease will now cripple her for the rest of her life. An invaluable public servant dies in a wreck or a robbery. A selfish and useless life lives on, untouched. The laughter of happy people in one house, the screams of people burned in the same block because some builder was careless or greedy or both. You won't be able to explain such things by logic. They won't relate most of the time to guilt or innocence. They're just part of the puzzle of being alive. We can't think about it all the time. I wouldn't want to speak about it all the time, or we'd be paralyzed and useless. So we get busy with the immediate jobs. We get our degrees, succeed in business, fall in love, care for our kids, improve our golf score, take life as it comes, and make the best of it, exactly as we should. But the mystery is always close. And ever so often, something happens so that good and evil no longer seem clearly different. We stumble into a blind alley where nothing is familiar or comforting. We lift our eyes to the mirror where the baffling reflections seem only to mock us. I could not speak more sincerely than when I say, thank God for the darkness that has been pushed back by the truth of science, the defeated enemies like polio and smallpox, those pictures like a next door picnic Polaroid shot of the rings of Saturn. But it remains true that all our knowledge is like a bonfire at night. We pile on the fuel and the flames leap up. We increase the circle of light, but we also increase the area of darkness on which that circle impinges. More light always seems to make more mystery visible. So what's out there, we wonder, and how should we feel about it? And what's in us, which is an even more pressing question? What shadowy forms rise up in our waking or sleeping dream life? Should we make ourselves a rigid creed into which all experience has to fit? Or is it possible to live with uncertainty and to love others in a world without perfect knowledge? May I use this moment to suggest to you that we let the mystery of life teach us to distrust dogmatism, to beware of any religion, for example, that claims all truth for itself and shuts the door on the possibility of growth and change. I read a note in a little church paper the other day that said, Baptists, this is a direct quote, Baptists have the whole truth. Nobody else has. West Kentucky Baptists come nearer standing for the whole truth than any other set of Baptists on earth. Now, this apparently means that even East Kentucky Baptists, marvelous as they are, have not found the truth as completely as their Western kinfolk. It's hard to imagine a parochialism so out of date as that. And every Baptist friend I have smiles at it, just as we do. We seem not to learn from history, perhaps because we know so little about it. It could help us to remember that when a mystery has been cleared up, the truth always turns out to be even more marvelous than anyone had dared to imagine. That old flat earth of ancient times, what held it up? Some thought it floated in a vast ocean. Some said it rested upon an elephant standing on the back of a huge turtle. One biblical poet I mentioned earlier sang about four corners that did not exist. That was his moment of insight. It happened to be faulty, but another one, in a burst of insight, not really knowing anything about gravity, said, "He hangeth the earth upon nothing." There's no hint that anyone paid any attention to such an odd, mystical comment. But when new knowledge came, it turned out that his wild guess was true, and that the truth was even grander than he knew. That this earth is round, that it is white and blue and brown like an agate marble, hanging in space, traveling 600 million miles a year around a flaming star. The mystery only grows as our vision clears. Fossils used to bug people. How did they get into those layers of rocks? I actually knew a professor once in a church-related college who thought and said in the classroom that God had put them there on purpose to puzzle skeptics. It was a curious view of God, I thought, that the ultimate mystery, the maker of heaven and earth in Judeo-Christian thought, should be playing little games with trilobites and dinosaur eggs. But the professor seemed very positive. I'm sure that for some of his students, later, when the mystery cleared up a bit, and they learned about the long leisureliness of this marvelous creation, the slow story of the evolution of life, it was far more wonderful than my old professor's rather derogatory guess. If knowledge becomes more exciting as we push back the edges of darkness in our physical world, may it not also be true of what we call our spiritual life, our intuitions of meaning and purpose, our ability to get along without maiming and killing one another? Is it hopeless to think that we may yet discover that love really is stronger than hate? That understanding makes more sense than the prejudices that feed our pride? It all looks far off, yet we seem to evolve slowly when it comes to what is in our head and heart, slumbering there. But in the meantime, there is light enough to live by, and we can hope, as Paul did, for more and more. He understood the paradox of his religion, and I wonder sometimes if some of us ever do, that at its heart was the deepest mystery of all. That strange sign that no one could have imagined would ever carry such a load of meaning. Those crossed sticks that form a cross. It should have spelled defeat and been the end. But another mystery, greater than anything before, grew out of it. Small and frightened men and women, huddled in houses while their friend was dying, rose up within a few days, incredibly convinced that ideas are stronger than death, that love can recreate a presence, and that it is possible to live happily without knowing the final answer to every question. So what, somebody out there asks, do you live by, Mr. Speaker? Many years ago, I thought of not preaching anymore because I sensed an incompatibility between myself and what pulpits usually represent. That is, a place where a man or woman should utter certainties. I knew already that I had fewer of those at the end of each succeeding year of study. I began to feel acute pain and misgiving when some sincere person seemed to trust my comments more than I thought they deserved. It was about that time that I read a book by John Middleton Murray called Not as the Scribes, a collection of short religious talks this famous literary scholar made to the members of his communal farm family. He had, he said, only one certainty. And I realized when I read it that he had just spoken for me. That certainty is the one that sustains me. That love is the ultimate and absolute value. That human life makes sense only in terms of how hard we try to know what love is and how it can be turned loose to work. Am I always able to turn my face toward that sun, to be warmed by its heat, to see more clearly in its light? The answer is no. Like everyone I know, I have chosen on occasion to look away from it. But the question was, is there anything about which you feel absolutely certain and by which, when you have the courage to do it, you can measure the meaning of your life? And the answer to that is yes. It should come as no surprise that the series on love, ending next week, should be my longest ever, nor that my favorite sentence in the entire New Testament should be this one: everyone who loves. And when I read that, I want you to remember all that rich freight of meaning that the word love carries in the New Testament. Not a weak, sloppy, sentimental term. Strong, dynamic. Everyone who loves is a child of God and knows God. But the unloving know nothing of God and the great absolute, for God is love. Temper all our convictions with humble caution, eternal God, and keep us open always to new light in a world where it is often difficult to see clearly. We ask through Christ our Lord. Amen.